Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Catch and Shoot podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. Catch and Shoot goes well with both red and white and is perfect with a workout of your choice. Our co-hosts are on both coasts, and they have all of NBA Nation covered. Adam Stanko in the Bay Area, and Noah Kozlov in the Big Apple.
Mike, what's the... I'm sure you've been asked 100 times, but I'm going to make it 101. What's the origin of the bang call?
It's not a anything great story. It just comes from when I was a student at Fordham. Not only did I, as a student broadcaster, I broadcast a bunch of the games. Michael Kay was another one of the broadcasters I was with there yet. And of course, the great Yankee announcer. Bob Papa was the broadcaster there. Charlie Slows, who's been doing Major League Baseball for years. So we would all, if we didn't go to the game, if we weren't broadcasting the game for the student radio station, we would still go to the game. You know, so like Fordham played St. Peter's in New Jersey, Fairfield in Connecticut, obviously Manhattan in the Bronx. So you could drive to almost every single game. There were a few games that were, you know, out of town that you would have to fly to. But any game that was in like 3 or 4 hours driving distance, we would go as fans if we weren't doing the game. So I went to just about every Fordham game my sophomore year. And when Fordham had a couple of really good outside shooters, and whenever they would hit an outside shot, as a fan, you know, I'm all pumped up for my school, I would yell out bang. And it just became like a tradition for me when one of the Fordham players would hit it. And then I tried this, you know what, maybe I'll use that on the air. And I actually used it on the air for a couple of Fordham radio casts, and I didn't like the way it sounded. I'm like, I don't think I like that. So I stopped using it, and I didn't start using it again until I started doing television play-by-play. And that's actually Sports Channel was the first time. So I tried it at first, didn't like it, and brought it back. And then after I started doing a little bit on TV, some people said they liked it and thought it was good. And one of the reasons I left it in is because it's usually in a big moment when the crowd's going crazy. And when the crowd's going crazy, you don't want to be screaming a whole lot of words to try and get over the crowd. So it's a good, quick, concise call that gets you in and out when the crowd level is so high, because the human voice is not made to be, you know, screaming for 15 seconds. I don't have that strong a voice for that. So it turned out to be a really nice, quick, concise call to amplify a big moment without talking too much.
I love that. I love the analytical breakdown of that call. And meanwhile, it's iconic. I mean, nothing screams modern day NBA finals more than that call. And so as fans, we thank you that you can give us that.
That was dope.
What did you learn about the business then that you still reflect back on sometimes now?
Man, it's about really the storytelling. I think when I became a play-by-play announcer, a lot of the broadcast is steeped in not just the stats, but the storytelling, get to into locker rooms before games. And when I was a field reporter, a lot of the legwork was getting inside the locker room, asking guys how they prepared for the game, you know, what's going on in their lives away from the court, how their families are doing, what their relationship with the coach is like, what that game means to them, how big is it in the big picture of things for them. I think those were some of the fundamental things that I learned coming up through the business that some of the best broadcasts beyond the stats, whether a team goes 0-for-27 from 3-point range or 27-for-27, it's the journey, right? It's you know, it's Enes Kanter waking up at 4 a.m. during Ramadan to drink 16 ounces of water or 32 ounces of water and have some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for energy because it's Ramadan and he can't eat or drink during the daylight hours, and to know that at halftime he's going to go into the locker room and finally get a chance to eat and drink because sundown was officially at 8:36 p.m. that night. Those are some of the backstories that, for me, I learned really enhance a broadcast. You know, I work with Hubie Brown. Nobody is better tactically than he is. He's going to take care of the nuts and bolts, the X's and O's, and, you know, my job is to set him up for things like that. But I feel that part of my responsibility as a play-by-play announcer is to, you know, talk about a Damian Lillard who, you know, was a two-star athlete coming out of high school and couldn't even get on an AAU team that was any good to get recognized on the circuit and to see where he is now. Those kinds of things, I think, ultimately, for the casual fan, make the casual fan at home say, wow, that's really cool. That's interesting.
Getting to call games with Hubie Brown, I mean, as fans and as basketball lovers, like, we appreciate Hubie on a whole nother level. And obviously he's turned into this iconic figure over the last couple decades. But working with him as much as you have, what are some things you've learned about the game, not just calling games, but also just spending time with him during the day leading up to a game or the night before?
You know, the guy's mind is as sharp as a tack. Unbelievable how he dissects games. And the things that I've learned is, you know, the NBA is very much a matchup-driven game. And in particular now, the way the game's evolved with the heavy emphasis on threes, it's kind of at the opposite end of, you know, what I see Hubie kind of preaching sometimes. He won't understand a team taking a 3-on-2 and running a layup and hitting the foul line 45 degrees, cut in and take the layup on a 3-on-2, as opposed to a guy hitting the foul line and flaring out to the corner for a 3-pointer. He's quick to be able to point out advantages that teams might want to be looking at if they're looking at being successful in a game. I think another thing I've learned is he's really partial to running stuff to get something, as opposed to being more of a kind of a random continuity type of coach. But you know, what he sees is so next level, guys, in terms of you know, what teams need to get to, guys that can give them an advantage when they need it, defensively, being able to be precise. And, you know, I guess in summary, like, it's the details that really add up to wins in the NBA, and the teams that actually have time to practice those details on closeouts, on contesting shots, on, like I said, hitting you know, entering the ball to the wing before you try and get into the post, as opposed to just throwing it into the post and it getting picked off. Those little things actually matter. I think that's probably the bottom line on what I've learned in all the years that I've worked with the great Hall of Famer, Hubie Brown.
How late's he staying out at night on the road?
Be honest.
Hey, nobody works the lounge better than he does, honestly. You get him with a glass of Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot, and to hear him recall some of the stories of when he was a first-year assistant coach with Larry Costello, working in the NBA and dealing with Oscar and dealing with Kareem. And it really is a few generations back that is eye-opening. And his ability to recall is amazing, one thing, and then to recall it with the detail that he does is great. He is the best storyteller in the NBA that I'll ever be around.
Who is the group of great hangs on the road?
Man, Doug Collins is in my top five. Hubie's in my top five. you need a great wingman to have a great meal and talk basketball. That's PJ Carlissimo.
Okay.
PJ's in the top five. And then Charles Barkley has to be in my top five because everybody that – he's like the Pied Piper. He's going to pick up a group of people as we walk or as we dine or as we have cocktails. The group of five will turn into a group of 50 by the night, and everybody will have Charles's phone number, and everybody will be his best friend. He'll be the fourth guy, and then you know what? I got to put my who else do I have to put on my all hangout team?
You don't have to get five.
Okay. I was going to try and give you a starting five, but I'll throw myself in there too because my stamina is pretty good.
As the dad says, hey, that guy played with Michael Jordan. That guy won a championship with the Chicago Bulls. You know, there's an allure to that. You know, you see the look on somebody's face when they hear that, especially a young kid, that, you know, if I didn't stay in Chicago or if I hadn't won a championship in San Antonio, that wouldn't exist. You know, everybody's always going to know about Kobe, Tim Duncan, you know, the top players. But there's guys like me, you know, mid-level guys, I guess you could say, that you really need to think about, you know, how your career plays out. Because do you want to be looked at as a guy that, you know, hey, in my case, played 13 years and then nobody remembers you? But, hey, I made a lot of money and I'm good and I drive a nice car and live in a big house. Or do you want to be somebody that people remember for certain reasons? Because a lot of these guys, you know, if you remove players out of Philly or you remove a guy out of Denver or you remove a guy out of Phoenix, people don't know who you are. And I'm not saying that, hey, it's nice to have people remember who you are, but I just feel like I have something that's special that unfortunately other guys don't have. And, you know, Patrick Ewing and I are friends, but there's a certain part of him that eats away every time I come around because, you know, he knows that I have something that he doesn't. That's a championship. And I'm not saying, well, it was because of me that we won the championship, but I was part of that team. I made the necessary sacrifices. I put in the work. And that's something that, unfortunately for him, when people talk Patrick Ewing, they talk about, man, one of the best centers of all time, but Charles Barkley, one of the best forwards, power forwards, players, however you want to talk about it. But Karl Malone, one of the best power forwards of all time. But, so, you know, it's unfortunate. But I have something that, you know, I can always hang my hat on and something that I truly believe that I was part of that is special. And because of that, people remember me. It's not that I'm so hooked on people remembering me, but it's the reason why that makes me proud.
The Jordan Rules book comes out in 1992. And I know a few years ago, someone wrote an article and said it was the ultimate Woj bomb at the time. Being a member of the team and all these revelations, I mean, you pick a page on the Jordan Rules book and there is just gossip and chaos and all this wild stuff going on when we didn't hear about it regularly through social media. What was it like on the team when all this stuff came to light in Sam Smith's book?
You know, a lot of it, some of that stuff we didn't know about, that, you know, all the stuff that was happening behind the scenes. I mean, at this point now, everybody knows who Sam Smith's source was. It was Phil Jackson. Right. And Phil Jackson was the great manipulator of the media because back then there was no social media. There was no cell phones initially when all this stuff was happening, internet. So your only source of news was what came out in the paper the next day or what you saw on the television that night. So those guys were kind of at the mercy of the Bulls organization and Phil Jackson. So Phil was very conniving in the things he let out. He worked relationships with these guys. He knew who he could trust and give information to. And it was one of those things you always thought, how did Sam Smith get this information? Who's he talking to? And everybody always denied it. Not me. Not me. Not me. But, you know, eventually it all came out. But, you know, it, and the one thing I'll say about the Bulls is we were not dysfunctional at all. I mean, we got in fights a lot, and it wasn't just, you know, me getting punched by Michael Jordan or Steve Kerr, but that was something that had to do with competition. That's how competitive our teams were. That's what made our team so good. But at the same time, you had a bunch of guys that were mature enough, who cared enough about winning, that they realized that, you know, I can't win without this guy, or I can't win without that guy. I may not like that guy, and I don't hang out with that guy off the floor, but I need that guy. Guys, and then the guy that initially figured it out first was Michael Jordan. And then once he figured it out, everybody else figured it out, and then the Bulls started winning championships. We had altercations, and I don't want to use the word fight because there's really the NBA players don't fight. We had altercations in practice all the time because of how competitive it was. Not only were you fighting for playing time, but you're also fighting respect from your teammates. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have days off back then, and we didn't have, you know, load management and stuff like that. I mean, we practiced every day. We basically took one day off a week. And then if you played a game on Sunday, which we did a lot, we got no days off because Sunday was usually that day off. You know, we didn't have all these rules in the collective bargaining agreement, you know, that you have to have days off and you can only do this and you can only do that. So, you know, it got hot, it got heated, guys were tired, but yet, that carried over to make us a better team, that when we stepped on the floor the day of a game, the night of a game, you know, as long as that guy next to me could help me win, I didn't really care. You know, I'm not saying he didn't care about that individual, but, you know, I may not like him, but he can help me win. And when this game's over, I don't have to hang out with him. And that,
given how, sorry, go ahead, Will.
Go ahead. No, I'm saying, and that's what made these teams so good and so competitive, and how we went 62-20 and 72-10. I wasn't on that team, but that's just, that was a culture that had developed within that organization.
That was dope.
Do you have a microcosm, a detail that you remember about Iverson that can sum up what it was like being around him every day?
Well, I don't know. Like, it's probably nothing different than what, you know, fans watch, but just to sit there, and at the time we sat courtside, and to watch a 165-pound player who was just an incredible athlete go in there against those big guys and slither around them and get knocked to the ground and get a bucket and get back up and just do it repeatedly, time after time, was just an incredible you know what I mean? You were watching one of the greatest players at that position, at that size, ever to play our game. And, yeah, he was phenomenal. Just to get shots of, like Larry Brown used to say, to get 20 shots, 25 shots off in an NBA game, just the attempts is an amazing feat in and of itself. So, yeah, he was a special talent. And to watch him, you know, call for the crowd by putting his hand in the ear and then get 20,000 people to respond – uh-huh. It's not unlike what Ben Simmons did last night or what Joel did. Imagine that. That's like Mick Jagger standing at the – that's like a solo artist, not the Stones
yeah.
or Bruce Spring. That's like one guy standing on the stage and getting that reception. You know, it's pretty neat.
Being up close for that, did you get to hear the Iverson trash talk or other guys trying to trash talk Iverson?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, yeah, and – yeah, and it's like being next to the huddle. I heard all those Larry Brown huddles, but you never were like, so they're going to run a roll. You know what I mean? You never really brought that. You know, it's just part of having your antenna up, of being there. And, oh, yeah, Allen going up against Gary Payton or Kobe. And that's the thing that you lose a little bit now that we're seated off the court. And I get it. It's for tickets. It's not just in Philadelphia. It's basically – almost every arena in the NBA, they've lifted the announcers off the floor, and we were on the court in prime real estate, and now they sell that real estate. And I get it. But what you missed a lot of times was the facial reaction. Now, there are a few places where we still get to sit on the court, and it's almost like you want a fantasy. You'll get to sit courtside in an NBA game. You know, you're really fired up because it's a treat to be able to be down there, and you miss some of that when you're up. Like, I'll find something out on social media or on television or reading the paper or after the game, like, oh, really? I was at that game. Mike Scott took a drink out of a fan's beverage in Milwaukee on St. Patrick's. Oh, and then you see it, and you're like, oh, what about? You know, like, a little sip of a beverage, you know. There are a lot of things that you miss when you're not right there. But, oh, yeah, you could hear a lot of that. Hey, and unfortunately, you heard some of the things that were directed toward Allen over the years on the sidelines. But, yeah, that he definitely – he was a lightning rod in a lot of ways, and you could hear a lot of that trash talk during the course of a game.
How many times do you think during this year's NBA Finals will you just say LeBron, even though he's not out there on the floor?
No, I don't, I'm not. I'm sure he'll be mentioned early because it's going to be weird not having him there.
Right.
But you know, you really have to. It's all going to be about the two teams that do it, because the two teams that get there this year, it's going to be quite an accomplishment. Whether you know it's the East or the West, there's some other really good teams. It's not going to be an easy road for either the East or the West champion, and you know, you have to just focus on them. Although I'm sure during the course of however many games is, and we always root for seven games, I think there'll be graphics that'll show about, you know, great moments in finals history or great numbers, and LeBron's name's going to be there, and you know, we'll I'm sure show replays of what he did in past finals. So he'll be present in other ways, but it is going to be kind of different, the fact that he's not there.
Yeah, I mean, he's been out there for more than half the finals that you've called, and now you're going to be courtside and you're not going to see LeBron.
Yeah, well, the last eight plus the one in 07, so
right.
So nine of the 13 so far. Yeah, I've always, like, for example, Marv always had the to me the privilege and honor of being the voice when Michael Jordan had, you know, the zenith of his career, and I feel the same way. I think it's an honor and a privilege to call games of, you know, these great players like Kobe Bryant. I've done so many Kobe Bryant big games, and now LeBron's big games, and Steph Curry's big games. So it's to be able to watch history, because you know, 30 years from now, people are going to be talking about, oh, I remember when that guy LeBron James played, or remember when Steph Curry played, or Kobe Bryant. That's pretty cool. I'm jealous of the people who can talk about when they saw Wilt and Bill Russell and those matchups. So I think the same thing will happen 30 years down the line.
From way downtown.
10 years ago when you took over for Hot Rod Hundley, what was the advice that you got, not from him, but from anyone else, about what it was like to take over for a legend, given that you were just the second ever radio voice of the Jazz?
Maybe the best advice I got was from Hot Rod, actually, who said, just be you. Don't try to be someone else. Be you. If a young broadcaster is listening to this, the greatest advice I would give them is stop calling plays for your resume tape. I mean, even today with Donovan and the revival of Donovan and what Donovan's done, I have to be careful to not make a call for a highlight. Like, Donovan's so incredible that every now and then you fake it, and people know the minute you're faking it. I had one recently where I missed a great play, and then he did it again, and I could feel myself being like, oh, I missed that last one. I really got to give a highlight call on this one, and the call sucked. It was like by far the worst call I've had all year. And I hope you didn't play this, some intro to me earlier today. I mean, it's like, seriously, I could go into the records and get rid of it. So I think that from Hot Rod, just be you, which is I really followed. And then just in general, I think authenticity carries the day. You know, there was an era where you had to have a certain voice. I certainly don't have that. There was an era where you had to call it in a certain way. I certainly don't believe in that. I grew up in the Bay Area listening to Greg Papa, and I always felt whenever I finished a game with Papa that I not only knew what had happened, but I knew how it happened, and I knew more about the game and the league at the end of the night. And so we hope to do that every night on the broadcast. But I think you have to do it with a level of authenticity, or else people know you're full of it.
What was it easy to be you?
I'm a little bit of a nut, so if I'm me, there aren't a lot of others like it. So thank goodness for the rest of the world.
Well, I'm saying, was it easy to be yourself right away?
Oh, I mean, there was nothing easy I don't know. I mean, people have real lives that are really hard, so I'm not going to – following Hot Rod was not, like, the easiest thing I've ever done in my life, and having come off being fired right beforehand probably added to that a little bit. I mean, no different than any other job in the world, or I certainly don't want to equate myself to an NBA player, but, you know, you're better in your third year, in your fifth year, in your seventh year, and then – you probably, my eyesight's not as good as it once was. And some of those kind of things are falling, right? Because I'm getting old. But yet I probably understand the intricacies and pacing of broadcasting better. So probably no different than anyone else in their career. You just evolve. I'm sure I listened back to my first year's tapes. I would hear that I was had great angst and sucked. And hopefully I don't suck as much now.
Speaking of eyesight, where's your seat at Jazz games?
We're on the last row of the lower bowl. We have a nice broadcast area, and that bowl comes up pretty with a pretty good pitch. It's made for basketball, not for hockey. So you can see the game pretty well. My eyesight would have to be trying to read game notes, not watching the game at this point.
What's been the conversation around the league from broadcasters and other media types about moving broadcasters and the media away from the floor?
Oh, I think that we probably complained too much about it, which was inevitable, and we didn't do a good enough job of asking for standards of our broadcast sites. I don't have, frankly, people pay a lot of money to sit in pretty comparable seats to the one we have, and they can see the game pretty well and feel the game, and I think that we should probably be quiet about that. There's a few sites where I can't see the whole floor, and that's really frustrating. You know, the fact that Boston and San Antonio don't have, at least in my, you know, it feels to me, I'm sure they do, but it feels to me as a broadcaster when you're calling the game that it's just that they have a disregard for your profession when you can't see the whole floor. Like, that's hard. Like, that's hard to swallow, that someone puts you in a broadcast site where literally, if the ball goes to the far corner, I can't see who it is and what's happening because I have an obstructive view. And it feels very insulting. So that's probably something I need to get over. But I wish that there was just in these few sites that aren't great, I wish there was a standard by which, you know, you're between the baselines, you have clear path view to the entire 94 feet. Not too complicated, but, you know, that happens.
Hands down, man down.
If you were to offer advice for someone who was going to replace you on a broadcast with Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy, what advice would you have for them to working with those two guys?
Let's see. The first advice I would say is be prepared. Be prepared to just sit back. When they get something real fun or something interesting going in terms of a debate back and forth, just prepare and sit back, and don't worry about talking, because these guys they're so good together. Their chemistry is so off the charts. The second thing I would say is have a thick skin, because they're going to make fun of you. And I think that's the beauty of working with those guys. Like, we all make fun of each other, you know, several times during a broadcast, and nobody has a thin skin. You know, we all know it's for entertainment. It's all to poke fun. And I don't know if I've ever worked with people that are like that, where, you know, if Jeff says something on the air that I disagree with, or I say something on the air that they disagree with, you know, we go after each other right away and question them and ask them, what are you talking about? And it's really fun. And I think it's really fun for the listener too. The other thing is, you know, I've known both of them for 25 years, and I think the most underrated part of what we do is having that chemistry where there's such a comfort level. And it's hard when you change partners all the time. I mean, you have some great ones, but when you've known somebody, been friends with somebody from 25 years, you just feel like you could say or do anything with them on the air, and it's not going to be a problem. And that's what's made it so much fun. I mean, Jeff basically taught me the NBA. When I first started with the Knicks, he was an assistant coach. And Mark was always one of my favorite players. And he has such a great big picture perspective. And he's seen it from both a player and a coach. The amount of stuff I've learned from those two guys is incredible. So the other piece of advice I would say to anybody who's worked with them is listen as much as you can to what they have to say.
When you, Jeff, and Mark go out to dinner, who pays for dinner?
It's a rotating check.
Oh.
Now, if you ask Jeff and Mark the same question, they'll tell you that I never pay. But you can't believe a damn word they say.
So how about the first time you went to dinner? Who is the one to reach into the pocket first?
You know what? I don't know which one, but both. And it does pain me a little bit to say this, say something nice about them. But they are two of the most generous people I've ever met. I've had times where Mark has come in, and Mark's got a great taste for ties. And he's come in a lot of games, and I'll look to him, and I'll say, boy, I love that tie. And he'll nod and say, thanks. Next game we do, he goes out and buys the same tie, and he gives me the tie. The two of them are so generous. They're always paying for stuff. They're always doing things like that like I said, it hurts me to have to compliment them this way, but I have to tell the truth.
When you are sitting around having dinner, are you talking business, NBA, or – family or otherwise?
You can't even begin to list the amount of topics that are discussed. It's to me, in some ways, it's more fun than the games, the dinners, the rides to the arena. These guys, they've got an opinion about everything. Now, Mark is not only, you know, he's obviously a brilliant basketball mind, but he thinks he's a brilliant football, baseball, every other sport mind as well. And he has an opinion about everything. Jeff also has an opinion about everything, and usually looks at it from a different vantage point. I remember one time we had a discussion. They'd probably get mad at me if I told the story, but I'll tell it anyway. We had a discussion where we listed 10 people, and they wanted to know, all right, if this person, and it was somebody in our lives, either professional or social, if this person died, would you go to their funeral if you were on vacation? I mean, these are the kinds of different things they throw out. And it's,
like,
you know,
that.
At first you're looking like, oh, it's hilarious. They just pick these topics and they go back and forth and yell back and forth. It is, like I said, the time off the air and the car rides and the dinners are just as much fun, if not more, than the games.
The Catch and Shoot podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.